Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! Why are Americans so alienated from their communities and the political process? A new social movement provides some answers. It's called The Politics of Meaning.
Part of the whole difference of a politics of meaning in understanding the meaning needs is to say that that it is not true that the only oppressed groups in the society are those who have been economically oppressed or those who have been oppressed by virtue of the denial of their rights. That it is equally true to understand that virtually everyone in the society suffers from a form of oppression because of the way in which our capacity to be loving and caring human beings is systematically frustrated.
A report from a gathering of third-party activists in Atlanta.
On the left, we've had a lot more experience on building democratic organizations. We've learned things about feminist process. We've learned things about being, you know, in coalitions with one another. But we haven't yet learned this idea of how to interact with elected officials, elected leadership. And it's going to take a lot of learning, especially in this culture where it's seen as a bad thing to be part of a party.
And is money speech? The Supreme Court hears a case some say pits campaign finance laws against the First Amendment. A debate coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. In some of the top election news headlines, Bob and Elizabeth Dole paid nearly $137,000 in federal income taxes for 1995 and reported an adjusted gross income of more than $533,000, this according to their tax forms. Her work as president of the American Red Cross paid more than his job as Senate Majority Leader, but their combined income puts them in the top income bracket of American households. President Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton released their 1995 tax returns last week. They reported paying federal taxes of more than $75,000 on income of more than $316,000. The bulk of the Dole's income came from his $149,000 Senate salary, Mrs. Dole's $175,000 salary as president of the American Red Cross, nearly $100,000 Mrs. Dole made in speech fees, and more than $112,000 in capital gains from investments. In campaign stops across Pennsylvania yesterday, Dole described April 15th's tax filing deadline as the day Americans go down and give everything they've got left to the government. He asked voters to consider that they'd be able to keep more, if not, for President Clinton. Meanwhile, Governor John Engler of Michigan, mentioned as a potential running mate for Senator Bob Dole, denies making changes over the years in his explanation of why he was not drafted during the Vietnam War. Nothing could be further from the truth, Engler said in a letter to the editor of the Washington Post. The letter, published yesterday, challenged a column by Mark Shields that poked fun at Engler's failure to pass a 1969 Army physical because he was 2 pounds overweight. He said in a letter, in a blatant and unfair attack on my credibility, Shields characterized the explanation of my draft history as evolving. And finally, in Maryland, voters in the 7th Congressional District head to the polls today to choose a successor to Kwayese Mfume. Democrat Elijah Cummings and Republican Kenneth Condner are vying for the right to succeed Mfume, who left Congress in February to head the Baltimore-based NAACP. Condner owns a dental lab. Cummings is an attorney and has served in the House of Delegates since 1983. Now we're going to talk a little about independent politics. I'm joined by Larry Bensky, Pacifica National Affairs correspondent. Larry, last we talked, you were in Atlanta last Friday.
It's true, I was, and I'm back here now in Washington, D.C., and I should tell our listeners that we are in new studios in Washington, D.C., a great landmark for Pacifica. After many years in a rather dingy facility in Chinatown, we've moved to the Adams Morgan District, and anybody who's been having some trouble maybe calling us or getting through or getting responses, it's because we don't quite have all the phones and communications set up, but it's a beautiful new space that we share with Pacifica's Washington station, WPFW, and as somebody who's watched the evolution of Pacifica Washington bureaus over the past 25 years or so, I could say it's a great step forward. So it's really nice to be here on day two of our existence in these beautiful new studios.
Well, it's good to have you. So what was it like in Atlanta?
Well, Atlanta was a little disappointing, Amy, at the National Independent Politics Summit from the point of view of the numbers of people who attended. We originally were told that there were going to be about 200 people there. Then they said they had about 130, 150 registered. And in the event, there were only about 70 people who showed up over the course of the 3 days of meetings. And it was also a little bit reminiscent of some of the things that have turned people off about the left over the years from yesteryear, the extreme insistence on having workshops and caucuses broken down along gender and racial lines, the fact that in open sessions there was a lot of debate about what one could call nitpicking over words and various long statements, etc. But on the other hand, there were a lot of people there who were impressive, a lot of people who are really doing a lot of grassroots work and organizing. I think that probably the most revealing thing about the National Independent Politics Summit is that it actually wasn't a summit. There were a lot of people who needed to be there for it to be a summit who weren't. People who work, for example, running the new party operation, people who work in Ronnie Duggar's organization, especially Ronnie Duggar, who couldn't make it at the last minute. And, of course, the people who are founding potentially a new Labor Party in June. Now, there were some people representing those groups there, but they weren't a massive organized representational presence.
Was Ralph Nader there?
Ralph Nader was not there, although he was definitely on the agenda. People talked about the Nader candidacy and whether or not they would support it. And this is the faction of third-party movements that is basically not in favor of a Ralph Nader presidential candidacy.
Mm-hmm. What's the reason they give?
The reason they give is that this grouping, the National Independent Politics Summit, is one that puts great emphasis on having a great diversity of people there, especially African Americans, and that Ralph Nader has not been active in African American issues over the years. One speaker got up and said, "Where was Ralph Nader when we were all getting arrested in the South during the Civil Rights Movement?" Many of the people in this grouping, by the way, the average age was well over 40 of the people in attendance, although there were some young people there, but many of the people were civil rights and Vietnam War era veterans of those struggles, and said, "Where was Ralph Nader? You know, we were getting arrested protesting the Vietnam War. Where was he in the civil rights era? He was doing his consumer protection thing," which everybody agrees is very important, but he isn't seen as part of a progressive multicultural coalition by most of the people there. They did debate and discuss his candidacy, and they referred it to a continuing committee, which will debate it for another month and maybe take a position.
So maybe we can hear some of what some people had to say down in Atlanta.
Well, one person especially was, I think, typical of the more constructive people present. She was Stephanie Luce, and she belongs to an organization called Progressive Dane, and that is not named after the dog. It's named after Dane County, Wisconsin, which is where Madison is located, of course, the University of Wisconsin. Progressive Dane, Amy, is a group that has existed for 4 years. It's affiliated with a new party. It has presence in four different areas of Wisconsin, a multicultural chapter in Milwaukee, a chapter in what Stephanie Luce referred to as militia land in northwestern Wisconsin, and two chapters in the Madison area. And with this group in existence for only 4 years, they've managed to elect seven of their members to the 20-member Madison City Council. They have seven members on the county commission of 30, and they have two of seven of the school board members. So this is quite a bit of electoral success for only a four-year-old network of activists. And Stephanie Luce talked about that, and she basically outlined in this brief excerpt we're going to hear three areas where they have done work and where she thinks the left needs to do work in order to have some sort of electorally successful coalition.
The first thing is that we've had to really be bold about the fact that we are building a political party, a real party that's contending for real power. And I think it's very difficult to do in this time when there's a very strong anti-party sentiment out there. People have this idea that being bipartisan is a good thing, that sticking to party lines is a bad thing, that parties are inherently authoritarian, undemocratic, bureaucratic, corrupt, and so forth. Now, that's true of most parties, but I don't think that it has to be true. Just like with unions, because most of them are bureaucratic and corrupt, it doesn't mean we should abandon the idea of worker organizations. So I think we've had to be very strong about the fact that, yes, we are building a party. We're building a party that's asking its candidates to abide by what the party decides or what the membership decides. It means we have to reassert the idea of a community and say, look, a party is a place where people can join, they can quit when they want,
People discuss issues out in the open. They debate them with the people they've elected. They come to positions, and they ask their candidates to stick to those positions. If you counterpose that to the alternative, which is just individuals elected, usually by a very small minority of the population, who are being persuaded on issues by lobbyists with the most money, I think it's clear which of those has the potential to be more democratic. And we have to be very clear about that, that that's what we're trying to do. We have to reassert this idea that a party can be a good thing, that community, organization, and collective decision-making are desirable things. So we've had to fight to do that. A lot of people in Progressive Dane wanted us to remain as a coalition. We've been accused of dirtying local politics because we want to make endorsements, we want to make statements as a party. We're being called backroom deal makers and so forth, which is a very funny thing. But basically, we've just stuck to this idea. And what this means is that we've had to take internal democracy as absolutely crucial from the very start. It's something that we cannot compromise on. Now, at the same time, I want to say that maybe we should be a little bit flexible in the beginning. These organizations do often start out with 10 people, and it's not going to look very democratic because you're going to meet in a little diner, and it doesn't make sense to have an elected leadership when you only have 10 members. So you need to be a little bit patient in the beginning, and you have to stay committed to the idea of building a party, not necessarily committed to the idea that your issue should be the first issue. But you have to be committed to the idea of the party itself. It took us quite a while. It took us maybe a year of fighting, of a lot of really emotional meetings before we really started acting like an organization in Progressive Dane, before we started voting as, acting as an organization and stop voting along factional lines. So we need to be patient, but at the same time, we cannot compromise on this idea that our party must be democratic, it must be clear how decisions are made, the leadership must be elected, and the leadership must be held accountable to the decisions that the party makes. So that was the first lesson. The second lesson was that we needed to carry this idea of accountability even further, and to the idea that we hold our candidates that we've elected accountable. Now, this one's not as clear because I think on the left, we've had a lot more experience on building democratic organizations. We've learned things about feminist process. We've learned things about being, in coalitions with one another. But we haven't yet learned this idea of how to interact with elected officials, elected leadership. And it's gonna take a lot of learning, especially in this culture where it's seen as a bad thing to be part of a party. I think a lot of people, even good people that we think are our friends, once they're elected, they wanna be seen as individuals and not accountable to a party. And so we need to really rebuild this idea that it's a good thing for these officials to be connected to the roots, the people that elected them. So what we've tried to do is, first of all, encourage our members to run, but that's a hard thing to do, and we can't necessarily rely on that. Instead, what we've done is developed a thing called a candidate pledge. And for anyone to receive an endorsement of Progressive Dane, they must sign this pledge saying they'll adhere to our principles, our platform, they'll join the party, they'll make public their affiliation, they'll make themselves available for our meetings. And you can tell it's the Midwest because we also ask them to make themselves available for our annual softball game. But so they have to sign this pledge in order to be endorsed. The second thing we have to do is make sure we're ready to follow up on that. If they don't follow along with our pledge, we have to be ready not to endorse them. And it's not always easy. Again, often these are your friends, but you have to be willing not to endorse them. The third thing that's important about that is the endorsement has to mean something. That means you have to provide something to them as a party, support getting elected, support once they're elected. We have to have a very strong organizing on the district level, a mobilizable base, so that once they're in office and they're doing things that we want to talk to them about, we mobilize our membership to talk to that elected official, and so that this endorsement means something. It means something that they're affiliated with us. And the third point I just want to conclude is that we've really learned that we have to be very serious about combining this idea of non-electoral and electoral work, not just because they're both good things, but they can't exist without the other. I think the left has been very good on non-electoral work, on issue work, on movement work. And we've even, you know, been okay on electoral work, electing some independent candidates. But often these two arenas have nothing to do with each other. And we need to learn to integrate those in a way that they're talking to each other and they're working together. In fact, they're often competing with each other, right, for time and resources and money. You have to decide where to put your efforts. With a party, you can really combine these in a way that build the party. I was going to just end with an example of what we've done in Madison as a way of combining all these things together. Last summer, our bus services were going to be cut, all night services and weekend services. And let me tell anyone who thinks that local politics are boring, local issues are boring, when they're cut your bus service at night, that's going to affect you more than almost any national policy that, you know, that's been passed recently. At least in my case, it certainly would. What we did in order to fight that is we built a coalition of bus drivers, bus riders, church members, students, disability rights activists, to work with our elected officials and to fight back against these cuts. And we ended up winning on this issue. The bus services weren't cut. Highway funds were cut instead. And this... This just is an illustration of how you combine these issues to strengthen your party and build a movement. Thank you.
That was Stephanie Luce of the organization Progressive Dane in Madison, Wisconsin, talking about their experience building a party affiliated with a new party and actually having electoral success. Those in the Pacifica audience who are interested in getting a hold of Progressive Dane and finding out more about how they operate and how they've had a success, there is a phone number we can give you. It's area code 608-242-0480. That's 608-242-0480.
So, Larry, you have all these different groups, like the Progressive Dane and others, that are here at this conference in Atlanta. Well, I don't want to say all these groups. You had, what, about 70 people, 70 representatives. Was there any kind of synthesis at the end of this, any plan to move forward?
There was a steering committee elected, which will carry it forth to presumably another conference. There was a statement of principles that was drafted after great struggle over the wording, as usual. There was a sense that it will become some sort of network that will be able to help people get elected locally. But again, Amy, only about, as far as I could tell, 6 people who are actually running for office attended the conference itself. And when you hear the statistics about how many candidates are actually entered, for example, we mentioned this last week on this program, in California, there are only 3 people running on the Green Party ticket out of 52 congressional races. There's only 1 person running out of 80 assembly districts in California on the Green Party ticket. So unless you run for office, you can't really do the kind of things that Stephanie Luce is talking about. And there was a great deal of encouragement from those who are running for office to others saying, get into it. So what if you only get 5 or 10% of the vote the first time? And that's how you learn how to do electoral politics. So there is an ongoing organization. There is a new organization name, the National Progressive Politics Network. And we'll have to see if there is an actual summit of them and the other forces on the political electoral left sometime later this year.
Now, at the same time this was going on in Atlanta, you also visited another conference that was taking place.
Right. The Georgia Young Democrats were meeting in Newt Gingrich's home district in Marietta, about 20 miles up the interstate, and I spent part of Saturday there. I spoke to a lot of people about Georgia politics, especially young Democrats, grassroots activists in the Democratic Party. And we'll be doing a report about that later this week on this show.
Was there a different feeling? I mean, were they taking on the same kinds of issues in these two different summits conferences?
No, there was not the same feeling at all. They don't have a progressive feminist agenda. They don't split into sexual identity groups and racial groups to have caucuses. They have a lot more money, of course, the Georgia Young Democrats. They were meeting in a luxury hotel rather than on the campus of a college. It was really a very different feeling. But also there was a feeling in the Georgia Young Democrats that these are people who are actually plugged into the actual electoral system as it is. They don't so much want to change it as they want to win in it as it is. The people at the National Independent Politics Summit, operating with very little money and no roadmaps, are trying to do something very different, which is an alternative to the present system.
So I get a sense overall that things feel as disparate now as they did before this weekend in terms of progressive third-party politics, or maybe the main forces in third-party politics simply were not there.
Both of those are possible, and we're going to have to see when actual filing deadlines take place, which they haven't in many states yet, how many people are actually going to run for office.
Well, Larry, thanks for joining us. Larry Bensky, our Pacifica National Affairs correspondent. He'll be back in the last segment when we have a debate on campaign finance. The Supreme Court heard the case yesterday, oral arguments in a campaign finance case from Colorado. Coming up next, Michael Lerner and the Politics of Meaning. You're listening to Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Politics of Meaning is a movement that blends politics with spirituality. Started by Michael Lerner, editor of the progressive Jewish journal Tikkun and founder of the Foundation for Ethics and Meaning, the Politics of Meaning movement attempts to provide a response to the growing skepticism and alienation that American citizens feel in a society that worships profit and in a culture where a sense of shared responsibility and community is eroding. This week, over 1,000 people are attending the first national conference here in Washington, D.C. And here's an excerpt of a speech by Michael Lerner in which he explains his concept of a politics of meaning and its importance in this era of conservative domination.
We're talking about a whole different paradigm for politics. And so it takes a while to think your way into what would it look like to look at the world from this standpoint, from the standpoint of a politics of the image of God, a politics that starts from the supposition that one of the critical contradictions, you know, to use the old Marxist vocabulary, the critical contradiction is the oppression of working class people or expropriation of surplus labor. We're saying critical contradiction in the society is its inability to treat other human beings as created in the image of God, or in secular language, to create human beings as fundamentally deserving of love, caring, and compassion. And the experience that so many people have of not having that part of them recognized. And incidentally, I'll talk about this more tomorrow, this is part of the appeal of hate radio. What hate radio, if you listen to hate radio, what it says over and over again to people is, you are not getting the respect and caring and support and recognition that you deserve. And the reason you're not getting it is because these others, African-Americans, gays and lesbians, immigrants, whoever, these others, the Jews, the feminists, are taking it from you with the help of big government. Liberal big government is taking that from you and giving it to them. And they're getting the caring and respect that you deserve. Now, the difficulty for us is to that liberals and progressives have not understood that part of this message is true. And the part of the message is true that's true is this: most people are not getting the love and caring and respect and recognition that they deserve in the society. Okay? And that is not just the question of not getting economic rights, and not just the question of not getting political rights. It is a question of the experience that most people have that they are not recognized, that they have no opportunity to find respect in the society, that nobody treats them with caring, or that very few people treat them with caring. And the right hits on something that's a central hunger of people, and then it manipulates that in this crazy way against the demeaned others of the society. But you will never, ever win against the right. You will never be able to stand up to the right until you recognize what is correct in their message, what is reasonable for people to respond to. And when I have been in 1,000 gatherings in which I've heard liberals talk about people who are moving to the right with such amount of disrespect, with such amount of sense that these other people are the bad people and that we're the good people. And it's time to change that, to understand that many people who are responding there are responding for good reason. Now, let me say, I have two other things to talk about. One is about the Clinton years. As you probably know, or many of you have heard, the politics of meaning got its first surge of public attention at the beginning of the Clinton presidency, when Hillary Clinton gave her what was supposed to be her first healthcare speech. And then instead of talking about healthcare, she talked about the politics of meaning. She and Bill had been reading Tikkun magazine, which is where the ideas had been developed. And shortly thereafter, after that speech, she invited me to the White House, and we sat down and strategized together about how to take a politics of meaning into the public sphere. And the media went wild at that point, declaring me the guru of the White House, and fundamentally ignoring everything about the content. There was, I say this, I don't want to insult anybody from the media who is here. I don't think there are very many, however, in the room, is that the only place that had even a paragraph, I followed all these stories, one paragraph describing what the politics of meaning was People Magazine. People Magazine was the only one. Why? Because they didn't have an agenda. They didn't have an agenda, so they're about people, right? They're about, so they were able to write, so whereas all the newspapers and magazines that covered this, every single one, Washington Post, New York Times, the New York Times had a 4 or 5 page article on Sunday Magazine about me, and not a single paragraph that described in, not 3 sentences that gave you a clue as to what the politics of meaning was. Okay, nothing. Because they had an agenda. They had a very strong agenda. And it's an agenda that's deep in the media, and that is the ethos of cynicism, a deep belief that human beings can only be motivated by material self-interest, and that everything else must be phony or manipulative, that you're either a New Age guru or you have your hand in somebody's pocket. Now, the thing here is to understand that when you're looking for that, you'll always find it because, and here's the more complicated level that we have to understand, we're talking about building a politics based on love and caring and the part of all of us that wants that. But there's also a part of us that quite legitimately is worried about ourselves also and worried about taking care of ourselves. And that then, in a paranoid way, believes that the only thing that is possible is to just take care of ourselves and that to the extent that we worry about others, we're going to screw ourselves and hurt ourselves. And so there is a tension that goes on inside each of us all the time between the part of us that wants to go for our highest values and our highest vision of what's possible and the part of us that thinks that's impossible, that it really can't happen, and that the only thing that's smart to do is to just look out for number one and take care of yourself. Now, Bill Clinton's candidacy, Bill told me how he was reading the politics of meaning in Tikkun. I went to hear him speak during the campaign, and it was like virtually almost straight out of Tikkun. It was like, it was unbelievable, and I introduced myself to him and said, as the editor, and he said, yeah, well, I really read your magazine very carefully. And it was amazing to hear this. He used the themes of hope, of transformation, of the possibility of a society based on love and caring. He talked in this language during the campaign, and all the more made it much more explicit in the day after the election. If you'll recall, that election eve and the election night and then right afterwards. And what you saw in the polls was this huge surge of popularity as People dared to hope again in the early, so from November of 1992 until March, April of 93, he had tremendous popularity, a surge of excitement and hopefulness. Peter mentioned this in particular in reference to the health care plan, but it also extended to most of his program. People were excited about Clinton and about what could, and we let ourselves go for the part of ourselves that was most hopeful. But whenever people do that, there is a simultaneous other part of ourselves based on the experience that we've had in the past of being ripped off, of being disappointed, of being let down by others, that makes us feel like we can't stay with this, that it's too scary to stay in that place. And so, as much as people were hopeful, there was another part of them that was saying, watch out, you're going to get screwed again. Do you know what I'm saying? And that these two things were in us, in much of the American public at that point. Now, what tragically happened in the early months of the Clinton administration was that for reasons connected with his own inner struggle of the same sort, okay? Get it? This is another human being on the planet, okay? Not the president, but another human being on the planet. This guy was also in the same struggles inside himself and surrounded by people who were saying, forget about the possibility of possibility. Forget about transformation. Be realistic. Be in the real world. The real world is power, manipulation of power within this system as it is. And within that framework, and there were many people around him pushing him in that direction, he then bought into saying, okay, well then we've got to compromise on X, Y, Z, A, B, and C. And so in area after area in those first few months, he moved away from some of the promises that he had made. And not just moved away, but did not explain to people why he was moving away. There were moments when you might have said it was understandable that he moved away from a particular part of his program because of the political situation. But to then turn to us and say, here's why I'm doing it. Here's what I need to do in order to build the kind of vision that we all share. I have to compromise here and there, but it's in order to make this other part work. But he didn't do that. Instead, he was advised to be realistic. And I was witness to some of these struggles that went on in the White House at that time. And what I can say to you about it is that there was an intense struggle going on about how much to go for a framework of hope and possibility and how much to be realistic. And the more realistic he became, that is to say, compromising on his ideals, the more the rest of the population responded by saying, just what we were afraid of. We've been hoodwinked. We have been tricked. By the early part of May, a tremendous drop in his popularity in the polls, which the media interpreted in the following way. They said, "Well, he has made a leap to the left, and the people don't support it." But if you looked at the actual reality of his programs, that wasn't what was happening in those early months. It wasn't that there was any leap to the left. On the contrary, the main programmatic commitment that they had was to balance the budget and then NAFTA. It was not true. And in the areas, one area after another, in Gays in the military, in Lonnie Guinier, in Western grazing lands, rights for China, he was moving away from the things that made people hope. When people feel that their hopes have been manipulated in that way, once again, they respond with tremendous upset and anger. And that is what happened in the early years, in those next 2 years of the Clinton presidency, is that people felt that they had been manipulated. People felt that, I can't maintain this if he can't stand up for what he said was possible. Because he was saying to us that it is possible to build a world to challenge the ethos of the Reagan-Bush years, to build a world in which we would be in it together, and which we would care for each other, and in which there would be a new bottom line, in short. And then Instead of transcending the politics of self-interest, what do we get the message from his apologists around him in the White House? They're saying that the reason he has to make compromise A, B, C, D, and E is because it's not in his self-interest to do that, because it's not popular. Now, what people are hearing is, wait a second, if the man who is the most has one of the most powerful positions, powerful jobs in the United States, the President of the United States, feels that he can't stand by his own beliefs, he can't stand by his own vision because he doesn't have enough power to stand by his ideals, am I going to be the jerk on the block that stands by mine? Do you see what I mean? Am I going to be the one who wants to pay higher taxes to take care of a collective we? Am I going to be the one who wants to pay higher premiums for health care because to take care of a collective we? Yes, I will be that if there is a we. If there is some us, if there is some community, if there is the possibility of us reconstructing a world in a different way. But if there is no such possibility, then I'm going to take care of myself. Do you see what I mean? And so this struggle then led people to be disillusioned with Clinton and to move very far away from him, either into apathy and not voting in 94, or into a position of saying, I'm open to listening to the right. The right is telling us at one level, if the right is saying this is the moment to just pay less taxes and take care of myself, why shouldn't I do that when I don't see any other possibility around, when I don't see anything else happening, and I'm not surely not going to fall for it again to get tricked by these people who tell us that it's possible to build a we when here's the guy who is the president saying it. And I had this conversation with people. I say, I won't attribute it to anybody, but I've had this conversation with people in the White House at the time. And what was said back to me was essentially, well, look, we're not sure that anybody will be there with us if we take these stands and so forth. And essentially explaining that the way he was seeing the situation was the same way each of us is seeing it. Namely, wait, there isn't enough of a we here. Right? I mean, so that they said to us, said back to me, well, you know, it was easier for Roosevelt. There was a social movement there. It was easier for Kennedy. There was a social movement there. So, you know, I said, but you're the president, right? And what came back to me from people in the White House, I'm not saying the president, but let's say from people in the White House was, yes, but we don't think that it's possible. In other words, the same doubt and that fills each one of us was filling them. And it's self-fulfilling because the more that doubt is there, the more people then become realistic. And realistic means accepting the dominant frame of selfishness. And the more you accept the dominant frame of selfishness, the further the whole dynamic moves to the right. Do you see what I'm saying? It goes further and further, because if it's selfishness is the key, if that's what's in, then you get a president getting up and saying the words that could have been the words from George Bush, namely, the era of big government is over. Now, of course, the politics of meaning is not about big government. On the contrary, that was one of the ways that the media tried to distort what we were saying and to pretend that what we simply wanted to do was to put a new face onto big government policies of the Democrats. And in our literature, you'll see very clearly articulated a concern to downsize government, but to do it in a socially responsible way, in a way that doesn't screw poor people in the process, but to get government back into the hands of people in some real way. But nevertheless, when you have that kind of statement being made from Clinton, it's a representation of how far the political dialogue has moved to the right. And it's moved to the right because of that lack of hopefulness, that despair that people have. So articulating a different vision today is harder for us. It's a difficult period to do it. And yet, when you get somebody like Buchanan coming forward and talking about recognition in the way he did, and talking about some of the ethical and spiritual issues in the way he did, you might say, well, wait a second, wasn't it all economic? Peter alluded to this. No. If you see his economic program, it's not fundamentally different than what was being said by Gephardt and what was being said by AFL-CIO and by other liberal Democrats and by Ralph Nader. He was attacking the same things but why weren't people responding when it was being attacked from the Naders and the AFL-CIO? They weren't responding because there was this other level that Buchanan was simultaneously addressing, the level of a hunger that people have for recognition, for being seen, for having their needs being recognized as real needs. Part of the whole difference of a politics of meaning in understanding the meaning needs is to say that it is not true that the only oppressed groups in the society are those who have been economically oppressed or those who have been oppressed by virtue of the denial of their rights. That it is equally true to understand that virtually everyone in this society suffers from a form of oppression because of the way in which our capacity to be loving and caring human beings is systematically frustrated. And that is a central oppression of this reality. So to understand and really work through what a politics would be that takes that into account is really is part of what the task of a politics of meaning is.
Michael Lerner is a rabbi, a psychotherapist, and editor of Tikkun magazine. He's also director of the Foundation for Ethics and Meaning and author of The Politics of Meaning, Restoring Hope and Possibility in an Age of Cynicism. He was speaking to over 1,000 people who are currently attending the first national conference on the politics of meaning. You're listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like a tape of today's program, you can call the Pacifica Archives to purchase it at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Up next, a debate on campaign finance. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman, and joining me in the studio is Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky. When a political party takes out negative advertising targeting a candidate, should those ads be subject to campaign spending limits? This was the question before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday in a case involving the Republican Party of Colorado versus the Federal Election Commission, or FEC. A case which some say puts campaign finance laws at odds with the First Amendment. Yesterday's case grows out of a 1986 senatorial election in Colorado. The Republican Party launched a $15,000 ad campaign that attacked Democratic candidate Timothy Wirth. There was just one problem. The Republican State Party had already reached its spending limits on behalf of candidates. The state GOP said this was only an issues ad, not a campaign pitch for a particular candidate. But the Federal Election Commission disagreed and took the GOP to court. In turn, the Colorado Republicans asked the U.S. Supreme Court to lift the spending limits on political parties altogether. Jan Barron is an attorney for the Colorado State Republican Party. He argued the case before the Supreme Court yesterday.
Anytime you talk about issues, you necessarily talk about candidates and office holders, and it's difficult to talk about the balanced budget amendment without mentioning President Clinton or mentioning Speaker Gingrich. And when the party does that, what this law does is it renders their speech subject to a limit. And that's a violation of the First Amendment.
Inside the courthouse, conservative Justice Antonin Scalia wondered whether the spending limits made it harder for a political party to impose discipline on its candidates. And Justice David Souter questioned whether the limits prevent political parties from regaining the influence they once had. Former Senator Tim Wirth.
The danger in the argument made by the proponents of lifting the limitations is that we're going to further enhance the capacity of a few interest groups to spend even more money running even more negative campaigns. Now, is it a matter, as a matter of public policy, do we want to have more money running more negative campaigns on more narrow issues? And I think the answer to that should be no.
Groups like Common Cause and Public Citizen filed amicus briefs on behalf of the FEC and the Colorado Democrats, while the ACLU, both the Republican and Democratic National Committees, support the Colorado GOP's case. Now, here to explain and debate this issue are two people. Art Spitzer is legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of the National Capital Area, and Lisa Rosenberg is an attorney with the Center for Responsive Politics, FEC Watch Project. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Well, Art Spitzer, tell us why you're defending the Republicans in this case.
We think this is a case involving free speech. Tim Wirth was an incumbent Democratic congressman. He was, of course, as all congressmen do, in the public eye, making speeches, introducing bills, doing the things a congressman does, and the Republican Party wanted to comment on his record. This advertisement didn't say, don't vote for Tim Wirth. The advertisement didn't say, vote for his opponent. In fact, there wasn't even a Republican nominee in existence yet. It simply criticized what Tim Wirth was doing. It said that he purported to be for a balanced budget, but he'd voted against the balanced budget amendment. He purported to be for strong defense, but he'd voted against some defense bill. That's all it said. And it seems to us that's what politics is about. That's what speech is about. Where does the government get in telling the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or any other party that it can't talk about politics?
So, Lisa Rosenberg, what's your problem with that?
Well, our problem with that is who's paying for that speech. It's nice to say the Republican Party is paying for those advertisements, but the fact of the matter is if the Supreme Court finds in favor of the Republican Party in this case, corporations, wealthy individuals, labor unions, anybody can funnel money, will be able to funnel money through the parties to pay for that. No one will know, the public won't know who's paying for it, where the money's coming from. And we think that that money, the public has a right to know where it's coming from, and we also think that it has a corrupting influence or potentially corrupting influence.
Well, the public does know where it's coming from. We have disclosure laws. If you make a contribution to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, that's disclosed. And there are limits on that, too. The limit is $5,000 for what you can give to a state political party under federal law for use in federal campaigns. Are people surprised if the Republican Party puts an ad on the radio criticizing what some Democratic congressman is doing? And is it a problem if somebody gave the Republican Party up to $5,000 to fund that ad? I frankly don't see why that's corrupt or why that's even anything to criticize. Don't we want the Democratic and Republican and Socialist and Conservative and all the other parties to be saying what they think so we can all hear about it?
Lisa Rosenberg.
The problem with that analysis is that those limits that you're talking about that we support and we agree with only apply if it's it's express advocacy. And the Republicans in this case said they were not expressly advocating the defeat of Timothy Wirth. They were just educating voters. If this is just voter education, then those limits you talk about don't apply. Soft money will be filtered in through the parties into this system. Ads will be paid for that are supposed to be voter education ads by corporate money that is otherwise prohibited, by wealthy individuals who are limited to giving $1,000 usually directly to a candidate, but in this case could give $1 million to the party so that they could run exactly these types of ads.
If the Supreme Court rules that what the Colorado Republican Party did is okay, what are the implications for campaign spending in the future, Art?
Well, I think, Lisa, it may be right that more money will go into the parties and more money will be spent by the parties. Depending on how the Supreme Court draws these lines, most likely it's not going to be, as Lisa says, direct advocacy, vote for John Smith, but more general kinds of talk about political philosophy and platform and so forth. Indeed, it may be one different avenue for big contributions or corporate contributions to get into the political discourse. On the other hand, those doors are already wide open. As the Supreme Court ruled long ago, anyone can make independent expenditures, and we see plenty of independent expenditures by individuals, by PACs, corporate-affiliated PACs, labor union-affiliated PACs, So I don't think this is going to make a significant change, except it's going to be maybe more spending directly by the parties and less directly by the PACs.
Well, then I'm a little confused here, because the ACLU traditionally, and in this case, seems to be in favor of free speech, but free speech isn't free if it's paid for. You mentioned before, we heard mention of a Socialist Party, Libertarian Party, Peace and Freedom Party being able to speak. They can't raise anything like the amount of money that the Democrats and Republicans are using for all these 30-second ads and mailers and billboards and all the appurtenances of electoralism in the United States. We really have money out of control here buying speech, don't we?
Well,
I
certainly take issue with the slogan that free speech is not free if it's paid for. Somebody's paying for what's going out over the airwaves now. I'm sitting in your beautiful new two-day-old studio, which has got, you know, nice paint on the wall and nice acoustical stuff on the foam on the walls, and somebody's paying for all this. I don't think that means Pacifica isn't involved in free speech. I think it is involved in free speech, but somebody's bankrolling you, your members and contributors and supporters, just like someone's bankrolling the ACLU. It's a fact of life that if you stand in Lafayette Park with a soapbox, you're going to reach a dozen people. And if you can publish a Washington Post newspaper or a Pacifica radio station, you're going to reach a lot more people with your message. But that takes money. There's just no way to avoid it.
And that's exactly the point, is that the speech of the wealthy is going to be a lot louder and heard by a lot more people than the speech of the people that are in Lafayette Park. The homeless people that are living in Lafayette Park don't have the chance to funnel those kind of funds through the parties, through the Democratic Party, through the Republican Party. And even the Socialist Party is not going to get the kind of money that the Democrats and the Republicans are going to get through corporations and labor unions and interested groups that want bang for their buck. They want to see the votes in Congress come out their way, so that's why they're going to give the money.
I think it's very unfortunate that the homeless people in Lafayette Park don't have the same access to an audience that Steve Forbes has. On the other hand, I think the solution can't be what all these financial control laws are, which is to say nobody can speak more than the poorest of us. That's not a prescription for free speech. That's a prescription for silence.
You're listening to Art Spitzer, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union at the National Capital Area, and Lisa Rosenberg, an attorney with the Center for Responsive Politics, FEC Watch Project. Lisa, what is your grand scheme here? How do you propose to level the playing field when it comes to campaigns?
Well, part of what we would like to see is that the current campaign finance laws not be gutted by the court cases. And we're really afraid that that's what's going to happen by this Colorado Republican case, as well as a few other cases. There are limits on what people can contribute and what organizations can contribute. And there are prohibitions against labor unions and corporations contributing directly to a candidate. And we would like to see those upheld. We don't want to see those campaign finance laws gutted, which we're afraid would happen if the Supreme Court finds in favor of the Colorado Republicans.
Do you want to see campaign finance laws gutted?
Campaign finance laws were gutted 20 years ago when the Supreme Court decided Buckley against Valeo in 1976.
Which was?
The main federal campaign finance law, which prohibited independent expenditures above $1,000, prohibited a candidate from spending his or her own money beyond the same amount that others could spend. Those restrictions, all restrictions on spending, were struck down. The result is that we've been limping along for 20 years it's like a car with three wheels and no gear shift or something like that. The system is a mess. And assuming that the Supreme Court does what we want them to do in this case, in terms of gutting the financial control laws, it's like punching one more hole in a sieve. We're already living with a system where people can make unlimited independent expenditures, people can make unlimited personal expenditures. As Lisa mentioned before, there's soft money sloshing around through the system. So I don't think anyone can look at this system and say that what we've got is a working system.
Ultimately, though, what would you like to see? I mean, at the ACLU, there to be campaign finance reform?
I think we probably agree with the Center for Responsive Politics about the long-term solution, which is public financing. We'd love to see public financing because that's a voluntary public financing, because that's a way in which the playing field could be leveled without reducing the amount of speech that goes on, without these kinds of what we think are unconstitutional laws. The big problem with public financing is that the ACLU thinks public financing must include not just the Republicans and the Democrats, but every qualified party on the ballot. And I think it's going to be a cold day in Washington before we see the Democrats and Republicans in Congress voting a public financing bill that's going to finance the conservatives and the libertarians and the socialist workers and all the other parties.
But until that day comes, that cold day in Washington comes where we do get public financing, your position would basically be to go back to the days of the Watergate days of as much money from any corporation, any organization, any individual just flowing through the process. And you may say it's like punching a hole through a sieve. I think we should be boosting the campaign finance laws that we have now and supporting what we have now rather than just removing all the limitations.
Well, let me
completely.
Take this to a slightly different level here. The name of this program is Democracy Now!, and we try whenever possible to talk about the concept of democracy in the context of electoralism, which is not very easy. What would both of you see as a possible way out of this mess, which you both agree it is, so that we would have a more small-d democratic system in this country? If, in fact, Congress is not going to basically have an equitable system of public financing because it would open speech to third, fourth, fifth, and sixth parties, where are we going here?
Well, the one place where we don't want to go back to the pre-Watergate days is disclosure. We think the most useful an important reform of the 70s was disclosure of these contributions so that indeed people will know where the money is coming from, and then they can make their own decisions about the importance of that, and that's what democracy, it seems to us, is about. It's about trusting the people. My vote isn't for sale to whatever bozo has the most ads on TV, and I don't think Lisa's is, and I don't think yours is. So why do we all assume that the majority of the public is going to vote for whatever bozo spends more money?
Those ads are there because they work, though. They're not there because people are wasting money.
Then what you're saying, I mean, why should a working stiff vote for a conservative Republican just because he puts on an ad on TV that shows Old Glory flapping in the wind?
Yeah, but if they don't know that there's a candidate out there.
Well, I mean, certainly the major candidates, the Democratic and Republican candidates, run competitive races across the country. There are rich people supporting both sides. There's labor unions on one side. There's corporate PACs on the other side, or both sides. There's no
That's
lack
exactly
of speech.
That's exactly what's wrong, isn't it?
Well, but if we don't trust the voters to say, well, you can see where the money's coming from, you can see who's supporting who, you can see what their platforms are, and now make an intelligent decision and vote, then why are we talking about democracy at all?
There's a couple problems with that. First of all, the disclosure is not complete, not yet. There is all this soft money being funneled through the system. And again, with going back to the Supreme Court case yesterday, if the Colorado Republicans win that case, there's going to be a lot more opportunities for undisclosed money to get into the system. And the other problem with just focusing on disclosure is that just forgets that money buys access once a person's in office. You may vote for somebody not because they have the best ads on TV, but if the person who has the best ads on TV gets into office and realizes those ads were paid for by a particular individual or a particular particular organization, then that individual, that organization is going to have access to that member of Congress or to the president or to that representative. You're not going to have that access because you didn't contribute money to that person.
People get access to politicians for all kinds of reasons. If you're a major employer in a congressman's district, he's going to talk to you. If you're a well-known entertainment or sports past personality, the congressperson's going to talk to you.
And if you gave $25,000, the congressperson's
going to
talk
to you. If you gave a lot of money, he's going to talk to you. And the public's going to know that you gave $25,000, and the public's going to be able to look and see, and the media will inform them, is that member of Congress introducing and voting for bills that are especially beneficial to you?
Well,
and
all
then
you're
the voters
saying is
can
that,
judge.
All you're saying is that the public is given terrible choices then between Tweedledum and Tweedledee, both of whom are bought and paid for by the corruption of the system. Isn't that what you're saying?
We live in a society where some people have more money than others, and that means that some people have more influence than others, not just in the political system, in every way. You can't tell Katherine Graham not to publish The Washington Post because I don't have enough money
We've
to publish
tried.
The Washington Post. Well, good luck. But as long as you're going to have newspapers in the hands of rich people publishing editorials and slanted news coverage, for that matter, as long as you're going to have people like Steve Forbes who can, and the Supreme Court says you can't stop him, who can go out and spend all their own money, I don't see how it does any good to have these limitations on everybody else.
I'd like to not be quite that pessimistic, though, and assume that there are ways that don't cost a small fortune that people can get their message out. There our proposals right now for free television time, free airtime on TV. Again, newspapers could probably run ads at little or no cost for all the candidates or all the major party candidates. So I'm not as pessimistic that just because you're rich you get to speak louder. I think there are ways around that.
If people want to find out, Lisa, who's putting money into whose campaigns, can you give us the number of the Center for Responsive Politics?
Sure. We're at 703-243-01. I'm sorry. It's 202-85.
Don't give us your home number.
202.
Whoops, that was close.
That was close. Don't call me at home. It's 202-857-0044.
One more time.
202-857-0044.
I want to thank you, Lisa Rosenberg, attorney with the Center for Responsive Politics, FEC Watch Project, and Art Spitzer, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of the National Capital Area, for joining us on Democracy Now! And we'll certainly let our listeners know when the Supreme Court comes down with its decision. Larry, thank you very much for joining us. And, of course, you'll be back tomorrow since you are in Washington for these few days.
These few days.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin and Pat Greenfield. It was engineered by Kenneth Mason. Special thanks to Bob Daughtry and crew who have put this place together in an amazing amount of time in our new studios here at Adams Morgan in Washington, D.C. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives and ask to purchase a copy. You can call them at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Tomorrow we'll give you our snail mail address, if we are allowed to say that without insulting the U.S. Post Office. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks very much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!